Psalm 11:3 says, "If the foundation be destroyed, what shall the righteous do?" And I believe that if we allow cracks in the foundation to erode away from our beliefs, that the rest of the system will crumble too. And I firmly believe that believing in an infallible, inerrant Word of God is the epistemological foundation of our other beliefs, and that one can only inconsistently hang his house on a skyhook when he has taken away the foundation. Let me illustrate the problem by a true story that is alarming, and it's a story that arises in contrast to Lindzell's book. In the battle for the Bible, Lindzell pointed out a number of schools that are drifting toward an inerrancy view of Scripture, and he listed a number that are taking a stand on the inerrancy of Scripture. And my two main criticisms of the book are that he did not go far enough or deep enough. He did not go deep enough in showing the epistemological or philosophical bases for the people who deny inerrancy, and he didn't go far enough in that some of the schools he blesses ought not to have been blessed. And my next illustration comes from one of those unnamed schools. I personally know and have talked on a number of occasions with this professor, and on one occasion I said to him, "Professor so-and-so," that wasn't his name, "I would like to ask you the following questions. One, do you believe that the Synoptic Gospels represent Christ as being crucified on one day or time of day, and that the Gospel of John represents Christ as being crucified on another day and or time of day?" And he said, "Yes, I do." And I said to him, second question, "Well, isn't that a contradiction?" And his answer was most instructive. He said, "I do not press the law of non-contradiction that far." Of course, if you don't press the law of non-contradiction, you never come up with contradictions. Now, that amused me, and the reason it amused me is because that particular denomination had just gone through a struggle over this, and they had a statement that said, "The Bible is inerrant in everything it intends," an inerrancy of intent statement. And some of the people were smart enough to smell a rat there and said, "Wait a minute, does the Bible intend to teach historical and factual matters?" Well, of course not, some said, so the inspiration was really limited and not extending to everything the Bible affirms. So they put pressure on, and the denomination forced the seminary to change its statement, and the new statement read that the Bible is inerrant in intent and in fact. Everybody breathed a sigh of relief and thought they've retained their orthodoxy. It was after this new statement was made and the professor had signed it that our conversation took place. That professor believed the Bible was inerrant in intent and in fact, allegedly believed it, but also believed that there were contradictions in the Gospels, and the way he got out of the problem was saying he didn't press the law of non-contradiction that far. Now, what could he possibly have meant? Was he an outright liar? No, a very honest man, man of real integrity, man of love. Whenever I see him, he throws his arm around me, says, "How are things going, Norm?" so forth. So he's not a dishonest man. He's a loving man. What's his problem? His problem is epistemology. Now, epistemology is theory of knowledge, how we know. His epistemological problem is that he knows nothing formally about philosophy. He imbibed philosophy through his language studies in his PhD program, and he bought into an agnostic existential philosophy without knowing it, because he assumed that when you pick up the major tool for linguistic studies for a New Testament scholar, Kittle, and his word book, when you pick that up and you study it, that somehow these people are neutral, that somehow that what they say is objective, when indeed it is not neutral and objective, but it is, presupposes a whole philosophy of language, a foreign epistemology, which that evangelical cannot adopt, for if he does adopt it, he'll ultimately, if he works it out consistently, and it just takes time, will overthrow the faith and he'll have to deny inerrancy or make such paradoxical statements as, "I believe there are contradictions in the Bible, but the Bible is still inerrant." Now, in order to get at the roots of that and to understand in a little way as a layman what's going on, we've got to go back to two biggies, Kant and Kierkegaard. Let's take a look at Kant first. Immanuel Kant, he lived just after the time of David Hume. In fact, he read the works of David Hume. Immanuel Kant was a Prussian, East German philosopher, and he is responsible for agnosticism, the view that you can't know anything about ultimate reality. And I want to say four basic things about Kant. First of all, the two streams of philosophy that went into him. Secondly, how he synthesized them. Thirdly, how agnosticism resulted from it. And fourthly, what new direction the Western world took as a result of Kant. First, the two streams. Before Immanuel Kant, there were two streams of epistemology, rationalism and empiricism. Empiricism says all truth comes to us through our senses, the five senses. Empiricist. You get all truth, as the philosophers would say, a posteriori, from your senses. The rationalists, on the other hand, were people that said truth is somehow innate in the mind. So the empiricists stressed the senses, the rationalists stressed the mind. The empiricists said it comes a posteriori from senses, the rationalist says it's a priori, independent of the senses. Now, to name some people, the empiricists were people like Locke, John Locke, Bishop Berkeley, and David Hume. They were empiricists in their epistemology. The rationalists were people like Descartes. One thing to make sure when you study him is not to get Descartes before Dehors. Leibniz and Spinoza and Leibniz. Now, Descartes, Spinoza, and Leibniz, then, were the rationalists who said truth is somehow innate in the mind. They used different principles. Descartes said truth is built on clear and distinct ideas. Spinoza said, no, it's an infinite or perfect idea. Leibniz said, no, it's a sufficient idea or reason, but truth is somehow in ideas. Whereas for the other people, truth comes from the senses. Now, Immanuel Kant was a rationalist in his early career. He believed the truth was somehow innate in the mind and your mind can know reality. And a rationalist is someone who believes that the rational is the real, that reality is known through the rational, or some of them say the rationally inescapable is the real. But at any rate, some kind of correspondence between the rational and the real, and man's ability to know reality through his mind. Whereas the empiricists, when you get to Hume, got very skeptical about that. They said, well, I know what comes through my five senses, but all this metaphysical stuff is nonsense. Throw it in the fire and get rid of it. Now, Immanuel Kant was a dyed-in-the-wool rationalist until he read David Hume. And when he read David Hume, he said, I was awakened from my dogmatic slumbers. I could no longer be a rationalist. Why? Because we're not born with a whole storehouse of ideas, like Plato said. We're not born with ideas bubbling out of our mind. The empiricists proved to me that all the ideas that are in our mind came to us through our senses. I'm born a tabula rasa, blank slate. Philosophers have their language, like every other discipline does. I'm born a blank slate, and everything I know comes to me through my senses. John Locke gave several proofs of this. If you're born blind, you never see anything in your dreams. If you're born deaf, you never hear anything in your dreams. If one sense is impaired, your ideas are impaired. If you're born in a certain culture, you have ideas that correspond to that, and so forth. So Immanuel Kant said, hey, that's right. Nothing is in the mind that wasn't first in the senses. But, he said, the rationalists were also right. And he put together these two streams and he reconciled them in the following way. He said, the form of all my knowledge comes from my mind. The content of all my knowledge comes through my senses. Or to put it another way, the stuff comes through the senses, but the structure is given by the mind. And there is no knowledge which isn't structured stuff or formed content. Because if it's just amorphous, you wouldn't be able to understand it. It has to have some conceptual cohesion. So what Kant said is, yes, Hume is right. All the stuff comes from experience. Yes, Leibniz was right. The mind forms it out. And he became, you might consider, a rational empiricist. But that's not what happened. Here's the net result. The net result is he became an agnostic. Why? Because I don't know what things are in themselves. I only know them after my mind has formed them. Suppose you have some amorphous jello pouring in, and you think of your mind as little jello molds. And the jello molds stamped it out, and you only know it after it's stamped out, and you get a star-shaped and a circular-shaped and a triangle-shaped jello. Now, what was the jello like before you stamped it out? I don't know, because I don't know things before I know them. I only know them after I know them. I don't know what it was like before. I only know it after I formed it. So if you ask Immanuel Kant, what are things like in themselves? Well, I have the foggiest idea. I only know what they're like to me, as formed, as structured. Well, what is reality like? I don't know. All I know is appearance. I know the way it appears to me, the way I must form it and think it. But I don't know the way it is in itself. Now, this distinction between appearance and reality, the way it is in itself and the way it is to me, Kant had technical terms. The technical terms are phenomena, more familiar to you, and noumena, less familiar. Phenomena means the way something is to me, the way it appears. Noumena means the way it is in itself. The real is the noumena, what appearance to me is the way it seems to me. Therefore, Immanuel Kant said, I don't know reality. I don't know the noumena. I only know the way it is to me, the way it is in itself. I don't have the foggiest idea. In fact, I can't know, because I can't know other than the way I know, and the way I know is through the forms and categories of my own mind and understanding, my own jello molds. Therefore, I'll never be able to know what reality is like. There is disjunction, then, between appearance and reality. Now, he had a second argument for being agnostic about reality, not only because it's filtered through my forms and categories, but when I take these forms and categories, let's take one that's very precious to any reasonable person, the law of causality. And let's take that category, which is a category in my mind. I'm born with this category of causality. I must think in causal ways. I don't know whether there are causes out there, but I must think that way and superimpose it on them. Take that category of causality and let me superimpose it on reality out there. And let us assume that everything has a cause. Well, Kant says if you assume that, you're going to end up in a contradiction. And here's the contradiction. If everything has a cause, then there must be a first cause, or there wouldn't be any causality going. There's got to be some first cause to get the causality going. But if everything has a cause, there can't be a first cause, because it would have to have a cause too. Why stop asking the question when you get back there? Everything has to have a cause. So you end up in a contradiction. There has to be a first cause to get it going, and there can't be a first cause. That's the problem, says Kant. Don't think that logic applies to reality. Logic doesn't apply. The categories in your mind apply only to appearance. Categories apply only to the phenomena, only to thing to you, but not the thing in itself. In German, logic applies to the Ding für mich, but not the Ding an sich, not the thing in itself. Agnostic. Two reasons for being agnostic. One, everything is filtered through my categories. I don't know what it was like before it's filtered. Two, when I take the categories and apply them to reality, I end up in paradoxes, contradictions, antinomies, paralogisms, all of the various words he uses. Now, this gave a new direction to modern thought, because after Immanuel Kant, everybody was saying, you just can't know. There is no way that you could know ultimate reality. And the new direction that things took was described by Kant's second book. His first book was called The Critique of Pure Reason. His second book, The Critique of Practical Reason, not really second literally, but I mean in this series, you've got to go from the theoretical to the practical. You must make a shift from the mind. If you can't think about reality anymore, then maybe you get at reality through your will. If you can't know reality objectively, then maybe the only way you can get at it is subjectively. If you can't know the noumena, then stick with the phenomena. If you can't know the facts about reality, then just stick with the realm of value. So you have a shift from fact to value, from mind to will, from the theoretical to the practical, from the metaphysical to the moral. And Immanuel Kant is a crossroads in modern philosophy. Without understanding him and without understanding how he synthesized rationalism and empiricism and created agnosticism, it really is impossible to know what the rest of the water going over the dam is really going in that direction for. You're not supposed to use a preposition to end a sentence with. I realize that. Not unless you have to. Now, after Immanuel Kant, we turn our attention to Soren Kierkegaard. Now, Soren Kierkegaard was a man born out of due season. He was really born almost 100 years too soon in one respect, or his influence came 100 years later, because he died in 1855. You would think he died in 1950 or something due to his influence. 1813 to 1855. And Soren Kierkegaard can best be understood in terms of his three stages of life and then several implications of that. He said that life has three stages: the aesthetic stage, the ethical stage, and the religious. And these three stages are like three centers of gravity. You only move from one stage to another when you get into a crisis at the end of one. You realize the futility of it, and you make a leap to the next, and so on to the next. The aesthetic stage is the stage of feeling, the guy who lives his life on the basis of feeling. The ethical stage, and you might, the best way to understand it is just make a chart and have three columns, and then I'll just put words of contrast here. The aesthetic is the stage of feeling, but the ethical is the stage of deciding. Here's where a person decides he's going to live, rather than just feel his way through life. Whereas the religious stage is the stage where you really begin to exist, where you leave your self-centered aesthetic life for your law-centered ethical life and get a God-centered life. For the aesthetic person lives around himself, the ethical person around the law, but the religious person transcends the law and lives personally in an encounter with the lawgiver. Or to put it another way, the aesthetic stage is the routines of life. He has a little interesting section in Either Or on what he calls the rotation method. The best you can do is entertain yourself by rotating in your boredom. The ethical stage of life, which comes only when you reach a crisis, when you're so bored with your boredom that you realize you must transcend the aesthetic stage and become moral, become ethical, comes only when you adopt rules for life that come from beyond you, moral rules. But moral rules won't do it, because sometimes you're asked even to transcend your own moral rules. Remember Abraham and Isaac? The moral rules were, thou shalt not kill. But God said to Abraham, take your son and kill him on Mount Moriah. Now Abraham was faced with a conflict between the ethical and the religious. What was he going to do? The ethical law said, don't kill. God's personal confrontation to Abraham said, kill your son. And according to Kierkegaard, you must transcend the ethical. You must come to a crisis where you realize that the lawgiver is more important than the law, that the God-centered life is more important than the law-centered life, that rules for life must be given up for the revelation of the life-giver. Or to put it another way, the first stage of life, the aesthetic, is life without choosing. The guy who just kind of goes along, life without choosing, just feels his way through. Or when he becomes ethical, he chooses life, decides to live. But the religious life is where the man chooses God over life. In other words, a life centered in the present moment is the aesthetic life. A life centered in a lifetime duty is the ethical life. But a life centered in eternity is the religious life. Now, with that general contrast in mind, let me contrast just the last two, the ethical and the religious, in order to see what Kierkegaard was getting at. And keep in mind always the illustration of Abraham and Isaac. Don't kill, kill. The ethical, the religious, transcending it. In the ethical realm, a man has respect for the moral law. But in the religious, he is responding to the moral lawgiver, and that's higher than his respect for the moral law. In the ethical realm, you are in the realm of universals, the realm of the abstract. But in the religious, you are in the realm of the individual, the concrete. Reminds me of the father who said, I like children, until his went out in the driveway the next day after he poured cement and saw his kids' footprints there. And he said, I like kids in the abstract, but not in the concrete. Well, Kierkegaard liked people more in the concrete than in the abstract. He said the abstract, that's the ethical realm, universal, rational, moral principles, the cognitive. Now, here's the key, the next contrast here. The ethical realm is the realm of propositions about God. Cognitive, religious, propositional language, such as we believe the Bible to be. But he said there comes a time when you must go beyond that in your personal encounter with God. A man can't simply believe the propositions about God. He must transcend all of that propositional language about God and have a personal encounter with God. We must leave the objective realm of truth for the subjective, because the subjective is higher than the objective. The individual is higher than the universal. God is higher than the law. Or in short, we must leave the essential realm for the existential realm. So Kierkegaard is the father of existentialism. How did this flow out of Kant? Kant said you can't know reality. Kierkegaard agreed with that. And said if you can't know it intellectually, objectively, then you just must choose it subjectively, volitionally. If you can't make propositions about it, just have a personal encounter with it. Now, with that in mind, let me go, secondly, into several implications of Soren Kierkegaard's view. The first implication is that truth is subjectivity. Notice Kierkegaard did not say truth is purely subjective. He said truth is subjectivity. And by that, he means that truth is not an understanding of, it is an encounter with. That the true meaning of truth, if I may use the tautology, is that truth is not objectively understood, but subjectively appropriated. Truth is subjectivity. Secondly, he believed that objective truth is not important to life. Now, again, I'd like to correct a misunderstanding of Kierkegaard that's quite popular. He did not deny all objective truth. He didn't say there is no such thing as mathematical or science or historical truth. He said that's not important to life. Objective truth has no direct relevance, and it's questionable whether it has indirect relevance, to life at all. Objective truth isn't important. In other words, facts have no value. And I'm interested in what's valuable. A dichotomy between fact and value that he'd gotten from Immanuel Kant. The realm of fact and the realm of value, never the twain shall meet. The fact is in the phenomenal realm. Value is in the noumenal realm, the real world out there. Thirdly, Kierkegaard said, revelation is personal, not propositional. God doesn't reveal himself in propositions. He might conceivably reveal himself through them, but the revelation is personal, not propositional. You can't talk, as it were, about revealed words. You can talk about the Word revealing himself to us, but not about revealed words. Words are objective, propositional, and the personal transcends the propositional. Fourthly, Kierkegaard believed that the doctrinal is not essential to Christianity. Now, he didn't say there aren't any doctrines, and he didn't say he didn't believe them. He said the doctrinal is not important to Christianity. Creeds are not important to Christianity because creeds are just propositional, just objective, abstract, universal. And the thing that's important to Christianity is the personal encounter with God through Christ. And he gives a very radical illustration. He said he would put his evaluational money on a pagan who is passionately dedicated to his idol, rather than a Christian who is indifferently related to the creed or to Christ. And that the one who really has truth is the pagan, passionately encountering his idol, rather than the Christian formally reciting the creed. Fifthly, Kierkegaard believes that the historical is not crucial to Christianity. He did not say he didn't believe in the historical. He did. He believed in the historicity of Christianity. He said the historical is not important to Christianity. You could be a Christian with the most minimal historical understanding. In fact, none whatsoever. The only thing he thought that was essential is that some unusual man lived in the first century. That's all. That would be the minimum. beyond that, nothing of the miracles, life, birth, resurrection of Christ. He didn't deny the virgin birth. He didn't deny the resurrection. He believed in those. But they weren't important, and they weren't essential to Christianity. The historical is not crucial to Christianity. What is crucial? The existential. Having a personal encounter with Christ, not whether Christ lived and performed these miracles. He's willing to grant the fundamentalist his fondest dream about the inerrancy of the Bible, even uses practically this language. And yet, he says, it doesn't bring you one bit closer to Christ. He's willing to grant the liberal or the higher critic his fondest dream that you can riddle the whole Bible and prove that it's all full of errors, and that doesn't take you one inch away from Christ, because history and Bible criticism is not relevant to what is truly Christian. Sixthly, he said, miracles have no evidential value. Miracles cannot be used to prove anything. In fact, all miracles can do at the most is force your decision, force you to decide. It's your decision that's important. The miracle doesn't prove Christianity is true, and the lack of it doesn't disprove Christianity. They have no evidential value. You can't use them to prove it. Seven, God cannot be known by human reason. He is totally other. There's no way that you can use the categories of your mind, whether the law of non-contradiction or the law of causality, no way to use the categories of your mind and understand God, because God cannot be known by human reason. There is no similarity. He is totally different. Now, Kierkegaard did use language about God, but he did not feel that that language really described God, who was totally other and outside the grasp of human language and logic. Finally, number eight, faith is a leap that does not terminate on evidence. Now, it is true that in his later writings, Kierkegaard modified the use of the word leap. He felt that the word leap was perhaps not the best word, but he didn't take away from the point that leap conveys, namely, that there is no evidence for making the step, the decision, the encounter, that when a man decides to follow Christ, it's not because it was reasonable to so do. In fact, it's paradoxical, it's absurd. In many respects, it's against reason to do so. But faith is a leap that does not terminate on evidence. It's not that I had a lot of evidence and it was a reasonable thing to rest in that evidence. For example, John Carnell used to define faith as the whole soul trust in the sufficiency of the evidence. That would be contrary to Kierkegaard at all. It's a leap or a decision despite the lack of evidence for it. Now, that leads me to the third point, an evaluation of Kant and Kierkegaard. Once we have an understanding of what they're saying, and incidentally, I feel that there are three steps that should be followed in understanding and evaluating all philosophers. One, we should understand them. Two, we should learn something from the view. And three, we should criticize or evaluate the view. And to do the third without the first two is very, very bad. And you'll see that we learn something from these men as we criticize them. First of all, a critique of Kant. There are two kinds of agnosticism. One is called the I don't know anything about reality, and the other is called I can't know anything about reality, or the ordinary kind and the ornery kind. Now let's see, which kind is Kant? Is he the ordinary garden variety agnostic, or is he an ornery kind? He is an ornery kind. He says you can't know anything about ultimate reality. You're locked off. There's a great gulf fixed between the real and the appearance, and you get into contradictions when you start talking about it.